Okay, so let me recap on where I ended yesterday. We were considering the geometry on a manifold based on considering the tangent bundle plus the cotangent bundle. And I defined right at the end of the last lecture the notion of a generalized complex structure on a manifold. So what this was, let me remind you, is a sub-bundle of the complexification of this, which is satisfies that the property that E is maximally isotropic, so half the dimension and isotropic with respect to the natural inner product on this, that E intersection E bar is zero. And so that much tells us that we have a complex structure on the bundle T plus T star. And then there's an integrability condition which says that sections of E are closed under the Courant bracket. And as I pointed out yesterday, the isotropic condition means that the obstruction to this closure is essentially a tensorial object. Well, tensorial, it involves tensor products of E. And there were two examples of this. One was a symplectic manifold, and so here we took the, if you like, you take the symplectic two form, and then you take the tangent bundle inside T plus T star, that's maximally isotropic, closed under the Courant bracket, and then you transform it by I omega, and that gives you a bundle E, which satisfies all of these conditions. And another one, another case, is where we take a complex manifold, and then we defined E to be the the 1-0 vectors plus the 0-1 forms. And of course, we can always, because this whole setup is designed to be described entirely in terms of the orthogonal structure on T plus T star and the Courant bracket, then since we know that a B field, a closed two form, transforms everything, well, preserves the orthogonal structure and preserves the Courant bracket, we can transform any of these things by a B field. So that's a closed, i.e. a closed real two form. So we can get a lot of examples this way. Now, the problem about this, it's not, I suppose it's not really a problem, but in practical terms, it's often quite difficult to check that this Courant bracket condition actually holds. I mean, it's even difficult to remember the formula for the Courant bracket. So I want to introduce another way of approaching this, which uses the idea, the fundamental idea that I said last time, that we should think of differential forms as spinners for T plus T star. Exterior algebra on this maximum isotropic subspace T star, we think of that as being spinners. And so I want to mention then something about pure spinners, because pure spinners relate very closely to maximally isotropic subspaces, and in fact there's an easier condition which enables us to see that certain things are generalized complex manifolds without actually having to check this Courant bracket condition. So I want to consider, so remember that forms, we're going to think of forms, differential forms, as spinners, and we have the Clifford multiplication on a form which is the interior product with the vector field plus the exterior product with the one form. So if suppose I have a spinner such which is annihilated by some vector, then of course if I multiply it by x plus psi again, so that implies that x plus psi squared phi is equal to zero, but the Clifford algebra identity says that this square is minus the inner product, so that implies that x plus psi is equal to zero. In other words, this has to be a null vector with respect to the inner product. So if I take any spinner and I look at the annihilator, the vector space of elements like this, which annihilated under Clifford multiplication, then that is an isotropic subspace. It's the metric restricted to this is totally null. So the annihilator is isotropic. That's true for any spinner. So a pure spinner is one where this is maximally isotropic. So the definition of a pure spinner. So a pure spinner is one whose annihilator is maximally isotropic. Annihilator has the maximal dimension. So this is a non-linear condition on the spinner, which in low dimensions you can write down concretely, but it's difficult to do so in high dimensions. So let me give you some examples in the context that we're looking at. So so we think of, so spinners now for us are forms. So let me take a zero form. Let me just take one. So, right, so this is a zero form. Right. So this is a spinner. And what is its annihilator? So we've got to say, what is the, if the inner product plus the exterior product is equal to zero, well, interior product with x, that's zero. So this is just psi, so that implies psi is equal to zero, if and only if. And so the annihilator of one consists of t. So the annihilator, and I can't spell this, annihilator. The annihilator is just t inside t plus t star. And t is maximally isotropic, and therefore 1 is a pure spinner. Now, of course, we can, this notion of pure spinner is invariant under the spin representation. This is an invariant statement, so we can apply anything in the spin group to a pure spinner and get another pure spinner. In fact, the pure spinners are basically it's another way of saying it is it's a cone on at least on an orbit of a highest weight vector. But anyway, we can apply anything. In particular, we can apply a B field or a two form. So each, remember how a two form works on spinners? It's you multiply by the exponential. So e to the b, this is also pure, because e to the b is part of the spin group. So the exponential of any two form is also a pure spinner. Another one is, suppose we take a form which is decomposable. So let me write it. I'm thinking of differential forms, so let me write it something like this. Then, what is the annihilator of this? We're looking at things which are this form. Well, here, because the decomposable form is of pure degree m. Then if this is equal to zero, then this term is equal to 0 and this term is equal to 0 separately. And so if the contraction of this is 0, this says that x itself must be a linear combination of the d by dx i's, which are missing here. I is equal to m plus 1 to n. And because and this one being equal to 0 says that xi is a linear combination of these. So xi is sigma bi dxi as I goes from 1 to m. So we have n of these. It's an n-dimensional space. That's maximally isotropic. So decomposable two forms, or n forms, are actually pure. And so also we could take, we could exponentiate this. Again, we could apply a B field, apply two form to this. And so this expression here, this is pure. And in fact, at least if you're working over the complex numbers, any pure spinner is of this type, basically. It's e to the b times the decomposable form. So what happens then, what I've said is that if you have a pure spinner, well, if you think of the group, if you think of the whole group, the spin group, then that it is it's an orbit, yeah. Well, maybe up to scalars. There's all this question about if you throw in scalar multiplication as well, then it's an orbit. But this here, I'm only looking at it broken up under part of the spin group, the exponentiation of the two form part. I'm ignoring, if you like, This is it's broken up here into orbits under the part of the subgroup generated by the two forms and the endomorphisms of the tangent bundle itself. So not the two tensors.
Where was this
notion introduced from the other? Well, Cartan, I think. Yeah. So in fact, there's yeah. So there are all sorts of ways of looking at this. So in fact, a pure spinner defines a maximally isotropic subspace, and in fact the converse is true, that any maximally isotropic subspace is the annihilator of a pure spinner, where the spinner is, of course, you know, well-defined up to scalar multiplication. So that's what we're going to use in order to describe in another way, this this notion. So what we have, okay, so it's a proposition, if you like, which you can read in maybe Cartan or these standard books on spinners, Cartan or Chevalier, something like that. That there's a one-to-one correspondence between pure spinners and up to scalar multiplication. So phi and maximally isotropic subspaces. And there's a fact, again, standard fact in this algebra, which is that if you have two maximally isotropic subspaces and you look at their intersection, that the dimension of this intersection is greater than zero if and only if the pairing that I defined earlier, this Mukai pairing, is equal to zero. Okay, so if we now go back to our generalized complex submanifold, then you see we can at each point. So if we have a generalized complex submanifold, we have maximum isotropic subspace at each point. So we have a pure spinner which defines it, at least a pure spinner is defined up to scalar multiplication. So we have actually a line bundle, okay, over the manifold. So so at each point of M, so if I have a generalized complex manifold, then I have so at each point there exists a one-dimensional space of pure spinners, each point M, such that the fiber of this subbundle M is equal to the annihilator of phi M. Okay, so there we have this, we can't determine phi uniquely, but there's a one-dimensional space. So what is this? This is like, if you like, this is a, you could call this a canonical bundle. Canonical bundle of the structure. So why do I call it the canonical bundle? So the point is, of course, that for generalized complex manifolds, these spinners are complex. So I should mention that, it's a consequence of this, of course, that this property, E intersection E bar is equal to zero, means that we must have, this is true if and only if phi bar is not equal to zero, okay? Because, so this is equal to zero. The dimension of that is greater than zero if and only if this is equal to zero. And because, well, pure spinners are themselves, well, phi is equal to zero for a pure spinner. So, in fact, you can't have real ones, which, well, it's clear that there are no real vectors. This says there are no real vectors in this maximum isotropic subspace. Okay, so we have this this line bundle. Now, why do I call it a canonical bundle? Because in the case of a complex manifold, that's precisely what it is. So, where was our example? So, one example I gave you of a complex, a generalized complex manifold was an ordinary complex manifold. So, if I have, suppose M is a complex manifold, and E, what I said, that this was the, this was basically spanned by, if you like, d by dz1 up to d by dzm, and dz1 bar up to dzm bar. Then you see that the corresponding pure spinner here is precisely this one. If you like, the top, the M0 form determined by these local coordinates, because the, well, it's just, I just did it before in the real case, this is the complex case, that the interior product of this, I'm sorry, I got these the wrong way around, didn't I? It's actually the conjugate of this. The interior product of this with these is equal to zero, and the exterior product with these is equal to zero. So actually, if you like, I suppose in a sense I've got it the other way around. If I'd taken the conjugate, well, if I defined my complex manifold using conjugates, it would be the canonical bundle. But you see, on an ordinary complex manifold, if I follow what I'm doing here, this is my locally defined pure spinner, whose annihilator is equal to this. And as I go around the manifold, this, of course, generates the, well, the complex conjugate of the canonical bundle. So these generalized complex manifolds come naturally with a line bundle, L, we call it L, which is the canonical bundle. It carries the pure spinners which define the maximally isotropic subbundle. Sorry?
It would have been more natural to use E bar.
I agree. I totally agree. I've It would equally have been natural maybe to define a complex manifold to, you know, to be where E is, yeah, well, exactly, define the generalized complex structure corresponding to a complex manifold to be with the bars. Okay, so there may be some signs which go wrong a little bit later if I do that. Anyway. Okay, suppose then that this we have a global section of this canonical bundle L. Then that means I have a global pure spinner, which defines at least the linear algebra part of this, the maximum isotropic subbundle satisfying E in intersection E bar is equal to zero, at least so long as this condition holds. What about this Courant bracket condition? Well, I'm not going to give an if and only if condition here, but there's one condition on this pure spinner which certainly implies that. So, there's a proposition, which is just a calculation, which says that if phi is a pure spinner, and it's closed, and d phi is equal to zero, then the bundle e phi has, well, the sections of e phi are closed under the Courant bracket. So if my pure spinner, which defines the maximum isotropic subbundle, is actually closed, then this Courant bracket condition holds automatically. This is not an if and only if condition. Maybe the if and only if condition is actually that d phi is equal to x plus is equal to Clifford multiplication, if you like, of that for some x and psi. But I'm not going to use that that condition here. So this this motivates another definition, which is really, sorry? The if and only if says that for some x and some psi, some vector field x and some one form psi. Yeah, so this is, you see, this is invariant. If I multiply phi by f, then I just change psi by df. So this is a condition which is independent of the choice. Sorry, what am I? Phi is a mixed degree. Yeah. These pure spinners in general are of mixed degree. The exponential of a two form is a pure spinner. Yeah, these decomposable ones are rather special. So this really motivates the definition of a particular class of generalized complex manifolds, which is where I first came upon this notion. So that is that a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold is a manifold M, it's always even dimension, real dimension, such that we're together with a closed form phi, which is a pure spinner in the sense of spinners above, and satisfies this phi bar is not equal to zero. So this is one way of getting generalized Calabi-Yau manifolds. Okay, if we have a global pure spinner here, which is closed, then this proposition tells me that the integrability condition for the generalized complex structure actually holds.
Complex manifold and take phi to be the
Yeah, so not a, I mean, so it's right, not every complex manifold has this property, because in particular, well, the canonical bundle has to be trivial. Yeah. So I mean, so an ordinary Calabi-Yau is an example of one of these. So let me give you the standard examples then of a generalized Calabi-Yau. So the first one is just an ordinary Calabi-Yau, where phi is equal to omega. It's the holomorphic N form, or M form in my notation. Okay, that's that the holomorphic M form, the top degree M form, is locally decomposable. Therefore, it's a pure spinner, and it's closed, and therefore it defines a, well, okay, we've got to check this one, but what is, this is a pure degree M, so this inner product here is just, depending on the parameter, on the parity, it's plus or minus omega wedge omega bar, and that of course is non-zero, because omega is supposed to be non-zero everywhere. So an ordinary Calabi-Yau manifold is a particular example of this, where we think of the holomorphic N form as being this pure spinner. All right, that's right. So that's right. So here I'm using Calabi-Yau in the, yeah, in the sense of a complex manifold with trivial canonical bundle. Now, the whole issue of Kähler structures is something I want to deal with on Thursday. In other words, there are generalized Kähler structures, as you might expect. So the second example is a symplectic manifold. In which case, phi is equal to e to the I omega. So how did I get a symplectic manifold as a generalized complex manifold? All I did was take the tangent bundle and transform it by the complex B field I omega. So given that the pure spinner for the tangent bundle was just 1, I transformed 1 by this the B field, and that's where I get phi. And this is closed. And okay, maybe we should just check this condition. It's easy to check that if I look at this, then remember that e to the b, where b is a 2 form, is orthogonal with respect to this, or preserves this pairing. So this is the same thing as the pairing of e to the 2i omega 1. But the pairing then is the, we just take the top degree component of this times this. This is just the degree 0, 1. So this is plus or minus 2i omega to the m, which, if omega is symplectic, this is not equal to 0. So this condition is that needs omega to be symplectic. So, and of course, we can take the B-field transform of any one of these. So maybe the B-field transform of a symplectic one. This is perhaps the most interesting, and in some respects the most generic example. So we take e to the, so the B field now is a closed real 2 form, and we transform the spinner by this, and we get another one. So so if we have a closed 2 form, a complex closed 2 form, whose imaginary part is non-degenerate, then this defines one of these generalized Calabi-Yau structures. Okay, now let me. I want to make an aside here, which is, I mean, it sounds curious to a pure mathematician, at least, that we should think of a Calabi-Yau manifold and a symplectic manifold in the same light, because they have many different properties. So, for example, if we think of automorphisms, if we think of diffeomorphisms which preserve the structure, then, of course, for a symplectic manifold, so if M is symplectic, Then we have a huge group of diffeomorphisms. Let's suppose that we're looking at the compact situation at the moment. We have the huge group of diffeomorphisms preserving the symplectic structure, namely the symplectic diffeomorphisms. So the Lie algebra of the automorphism group of a symplectic manifold is what is it? It's the functions modulo constants, right? If this is so, it's the C infinity functions on M modulo the constants, because these are the Hamiltonian vector fields. On the other hand, if we have a compact compact Calabi-Yau, then at least if the first Betti number is equal to zero, and let me assume also that I have the metric as well, that it's Kähler, then that implies that there are no holomorphic vector fields. And that's a standard Bochner vanishing theorem. So these are very different objects if you consider them as, you know, in the usual sense of manifolds with a structure acted on by diffeomorphism groups. But in fact, if we look at this extended diffeomorphism group, where you throw in the exact B fields, then their symmetry groups look remarkably similar. So let me just point this out. So now, suppose instead of the diffeomorphism group, we take the diffeomorphisms of M semi-direct product with exact B fields, then this, of course, is this acts on these structures. That's what we've done. We've produced geometrical structures on which B fields act, closed two forms act, in particular exact two forms, and so we can act on this by let's say the Lie algebra here. So let's just look in the symplectic case. So if we look at the action is the Lie derivative plus, so we take an exact two form, d xi, acting on e to the I omega. So suppose I ask that this should be equal to zero, then of course if we look at the degree two part of this, we see that the Lie derivative of I omega plus d xi has to equal zero. So this implies this, in fact it's equivalent to this. And this, if we look at the real and imaginary parts, this implies that the Lie derivative of x of omega is equal to zero, and of course d xi is equal to zero. So here the symmetries within this big group are the same as it's the same Lie algebra as we get from the symplectic manifold itself. Our B field has to be zero, and the vector field has to preserve the symplectic structure. But now suppose we take the Calabi-Yau, then in this case we have, what about this condition? Well, now the Lie derivative preserves the degree, and this increases the degree. So in this case what we have is that we separately have that this is equal to zero, and d xi wedge omega is equal to zero. So as we've seen, this implies that x is equal to zero, at least in the most situations. But what about this condition here? So what is omega? Omega is an M0 form. D xi is a two-form, a real two-form. So to say that the wedge product of that is equal to zero says that the 0-2 part of this is zero. If it's real, then the 2-0 part is zero. So that implies that d xi is of type 1-1. But now, again, let's assume that there's a Kähler structure underneath, so we have the dd bar lemma. So we have an exact 1-1 form. That implies that d xi is equal to dd bar of a function. And that function on a compact manifold is well-defined modulo constants. So in fact, the Lie algebra of the group of symmetries is again the C infinity functions modulo constants. Of course, it's got a different bracket. In this case, it's got a trivial bracket. In the other case, we have the Poisson bracket. But in some sense, the group of symmetries of these two extreme objects, very different objects, actually have the same sort of structure. So there's a sense in which, at least to a mathematician, there's a commonality between these two things, so long as we consider the action of this extended group on the manifold. Well, I just looked at a pure symplectic structure here. If you put in the B field, e to the B plus I omega, then of course this gets modified. Here you get d psi plus Lie derivative of B is equal to zero. And then, so if x is a Hamiltonian function, so the bracket operation on this involves, if you like, with the two form, the closed two form B changes the Poisson bracket. That's a bigger issue. I mean, this is just sort of local differential geometry, really. All I'm saying, this is just, it's an observation. I mean, you just sort of... The Lie algebras are in some sense the same size, but with different bracket structures, you know. So that was an aside. And now let me just point out that another fact, which is somehow the role of this B field, that although these two things, symplectic and complex, or Calabi-Yau, are extreme situations, nevertheless, you can, in certain circumstances, you can continuously go from one to another, because of the B field. So here's another point to notice. Let's suppose that M is now a hypercalar manifold. And so we have three hypercalar two forms. And omega 2 plus I omega 3, this is a holomorphic two-form, holomorphic two-zero form, with respect to the complex structure I, let's say, for which omega 1 is the Kähler form. So actually, I don't really need omega 1. All I need is this holomorphic two-zero form. So suppose I look at e to the omega 2 plus I omega 3. So this is a pure spinner, and it defines a generalized Calabi-Yau structure on this hypercalar manifold. What type is it? Well, this is e to the I omega 3. Omega 3 is a symplectic form, so I start with a symplectic manifold, omega 3, then I transform it, if you like, by omega 2, which I think of as a B field. It's a closed 2 form. So I think of M, first of all, as a symplectic manifold with regard to omega 3, and I look at the generalized Calabi-Yau structure corresponding to that. Then I transform that by the omega 2, which I think of as a B field. And then I rescale these things. So I look at, I can, just by some constant T, so this is still the B field transform of a symplectic manifold, and now let me put T to the K there, say, and let me take phi to be equal to this. So what this is that this is a pure spinner, so this defines, again, for each T, a B field transform, what I call it, the B field transform of a symplectic manifold. And now let t tend to 0. So if I expand this, I mean, this is perfectly okay because, okay, maybe I should have said this. This denominator is okay because what I get is 1 plus omega 2 plus I omega 3 to the k over t to the k. We're all right there. But the next term is equal to all the other terms are 0 because omega 2 plus I omega 3 is a 2,0 form. Raise it to the power 2k, it's a 2k,0 form. This is a complex manifold. This is the top degree of holomorphic forms. So if I multiply this by itself any further, I get 0. So what this is then is this is perfectly, this is algebraic in t to the k polynomial, and it tends to omega 2 plus I omega 3 to the k as t tends to 0. And what is this? This is, if you like, this is a holomorphic M form, 2k form, on M. So we consider this limit is still a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold, but it's now, in fact, one defined by an ordinary Calabi-Yau manifold. So there's a sense in which, in certain circumstances, certainly in this hyperkähler situation, the B field sort of interpolates between symplectic and Calabi-Yau. We'll see that in more detail when we look at moduli spaces. So in my last lecture, I want to look at moduli spaces, particularly of K3 surfaces, where in fact it's clear what's happening here. The generic part of the moduli space consists of things like this, and the limiting case consists of the usual moduli space we think of for Calabi-Yaus. Okay, so those are two comments, essentially, about these generalized Calabi-Yaus. So now, let me go back to the generalized complex situation and to discuss some other features. So, what we've seen here is what you might call a change of type through a family. So, when t is not equal to zero, the type of this is that it's a B-field transform of symplectic manifold, and then it degenerates like this. Now, if I give you a pure spin of phi, then it could, in principle, change its type. So what do I mean by type? So let me restrict to the even case. So this is phi 0 plus phi 2, etc. Then what I'm talking about up here is essentially the following. That you can show, actually, that if phi 0 is not equal to 0, then actually phi is equal to something of this form, where b and omega are closed. So if phi is pure and is closed, then it can be expressed in this way. So in a sense, I probably said that before. It comes from the Cartan's classification of pure spinners. So the situation where phi 0 is not equal to 0 is actually the B-field transform of a symplectic manifold. But on a Calabi-Yau manifold, a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold, of course, we impose the condition that d phi should be 0. So that implies that phi 0 is a constant. And so it's either of this type everywhere, or else it's of this type nowhere. I mean, the type, the change from the generic type to the special type, it can't occur on a submanifold. But in the general case, it can. So, in other words, if we're talking about not a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold, but a generalized complex manifold, then this structure, then we only have such things defined locally, and in fact, phi 0 is no longer constant, and it can, in fact, change. So this is a feature of generalized complex manifolds, which are basically I call type change. I mean, maybe there's a better notion for this, type change of the pure spinner. And to see what this involves, we should go back to that canonical bundle or anti-canonical bundle. So I needed some bars there. But so again, let's consider the even case, because this is. So I should have said, actually, I haven't emphasized this, but there are, of course, two different types of forms. There are even forms and odd forms, and there are correspondingly two different types of pure spinners, even ones and odd ones. And there are two different types of maximally isotropic subspaces. And we know this from the usual geometry of the Klein quadric. There are alpha planes and beta planes. Linear subspaces of quadrics occur in pairs. And so all of this theory, there's an odd version and an even version. And most of what I'm talking about is, the even case. So the symplectic case is always even, because e to the I omega is an even form. The pure Calabi-Yau case is even or odd, depending on the parity of the complex dimension of the manifold. Anyway, this type change is something which occurs, which I want to discuss anyway in the even case. So we have this our canonical line bundle. Remember, this is the line bundle which carries the pure spinners, whose annihilator is the maximal isotropic subspace subbundle. And so this is this sits inside the complexification of the exterior algebra. And what I'm looking for is this type change, okay? So I need to know when phi 0 is equal to 0. So, but you see, there's a canonical way of doing that, because we can map this to wedge 0. So what is that? That's just taking phi 0. And so this type change will occur when phi 0 is equal to 0. Right? So what is this? Well, it's a linear map from L into complex numbers. So basically, phi 0 defines a section of this canonical bundle L, which vanishes where the type changes from a transform of a symplectic manifold, B-field transform of a symplectic one, to something else. So in particular, if the first Chern class of L is non-zero, then that implies that this type change must occur somewhere on the manifold. So type change must occur. Any section must have a zero. Sorry? Well, so that's right. So it's a section of L dual thing. So what we've been looking at here, generalized Calabi-Yau ones, well, obviously, phi is a global pure spinner. So phi is a trivialization of this canonical bundle. And the first Chern class is equal to 0 for a generalized Calabi-Yau. Well, maybe before I talk about this, maybe I should just show you an example. Two examples, really, of where this type change really does occur. So one is a local example, and then I'll just talk about a global one. So this is a curious feature about these things. So this is a canonical section. So any generalized complex manifold has this canonical section of the dual of the bundle. It might be zero, of course. I mean, it's in the case of an ordinary Calabi-Yau manifold, the degree zero component is zero, and so this section is zero. So, you know, it could be. We're basically looking at the examples of a symplectic structure changing to something within the manifold itself. So let's look at the Okay, so the first one is, let's just take the manifold. This is a local example. Let it be R4. Okay, C2. And let's say phi to be equal to Z1 plus dZ1 wedge dZ2. So this is pure, right? Because this is actually equal to Z1. So if Z1 is not equal to zero, this is Z1 times the exponential of dZ1 which dZ2 over Z1. Okay, so here if Z1 is not equal to zero, then this is B plus I omega. And the imaginary part of this is certainly a symplectic form. This is closed. So this is the sort of general type. This is a, if you like, the B field transform of a symplectic one when Z1 is not equal to zero. On the other hand, when Z1 is equal to zero, phi is equal to dZ1 wedge dZ2, which is a decomposable one. So I mean, this type change occurs on Z1 equals zero. So we have this Z1 is equal to zero, where we have this change of type. Well, you can generalize that. So that's a local example. But essentially. Yeah, so this is a generalized complex manifold. Sorry? Okay, let's well, we have a pure spinner, and if you want to know what phi bar is, well, that's the Z1 plus dZ1 dZ2, Z1 bar plus dZ1 bar, dZ2 bar. And so what is, we're in four dimensions here, the Mokai pairing, well, a degree zero part multiplies degree four part, well, there aren't any degree four parts, so it's just the plus or minus, well, it's just the wedge product of these. So this condition, so that condition on the pure spinner is satisfied. This is pure because it's Z1, you know, so I've discussed about it being pure. The question is it integrable? And, well, you can see that because this is closed, then it's certainly integrable away from Z1 is equal to zero, but that's, you know, but by continuity, if you like, that Neuhaus bracket or whatever, it's got to be zero on Z1 is equal to zero. Sorry? This is closed, huh? D of this is a holomorphic top degree form on C2. The phi, yeah, is this. No, d phi is not zero, that's right. But if I divide it by z1, then it's closed. So phi divided by z1 is closed. Therefore, when z1 is, I can always multiply phi by a constant, by a function, and then that defines the same maximally isotropic subbundle. So away from z1 is equal to zero, the Courant bracket condition holds. And by continuity, it also holds on Z1 equals zero. So, well, you can spell it out. I mean, I could write down for you what E is, if you wanted. So you can generalize this. So suppose M is a complex surface with an anticanonical divisor. So let's call it beta. A holomorphic section of the dual of the canonical bundle. Then it vanishes on some divisor, on some curve, let's say, C. And, well, what do we have? Outside of C, we have, so beta inverse is a holomorphic two-form outside of C. Right, but it has a pole on C. So if you like, we can think of this expression that is being replaced by beta. And then if I take a local equation for C, Z1 is equal to 0, then I can multiply beta inverse by Z1. That'll be a regular 2 form here. So I can write down something similar to this here. So if you like, Z1 plus Z1 beta inverse, this gives me a pure spinner within here, and so on and so forth. I can just go around C and have these locally defined pure spinners to define this structure.
So, I'm confused about the analogy to keep in mind. Yesterday, I thought you were saying that symplectic is sort of parallel to complex. Now it seems like you're saying symplectic is parallel to labial, or complex structure is analogous to Poisson.
I'm actually looking at extreme cases here, in every case. So what this is really is a deformation of a complex manifold. So if I start with M purely as a complex manifold, then that defines a generalized complex structure. But now remember, right at the beginning, you know, we said that, well, I said that there was a certain asymmetry in what I was doing, that I was looking at the action of two forms rather than two tensors. And that two tensors, and in particular, when I discussed the Dirac structures, a Poisson manifold gives me a Dirac structure. So this is really, in a sense, what's happening here, that if I start with this as a complex manifold, and I think of beta as a Poisson structure, a holomorphic Poisson structure, then I'm effectively transforming that by this Poisson structure to get this new generalized complex structure. It's not equivalent to the old one because equivalence involves two forms rather than two tensors. And maybe that'll be more obvious when I talk about what the deformation space is. But I mean, all of the things I'm looking at the moment are really, well, in a sense extreme. I mean, a symplectic manifold is one extreme. Now, if I take a symplectic manifold and I hit it with the B fields, then I generally speaking, you can think of that as a generic case. And then the generic cases, those are generic cases of Calabi-Yaus, you see. So here we're in the situation where the first Chern class of this line bundle is definitely non-zero, because in fact it's represented by C here, or minus C, I suppose. But we can say that there's the sort of generic structure outside of C is symplectic, transformed by a B field, but it's degenerating to something complex over C. What is the big picture? Well, I don't know what the big picture is, because I mean, we don't have a list of all possible types of generalized complex structures. You know, it's like there's no classification of these. No, this particular case is analogous, obviously, because the Poisson structure, the Poisson form in this case, well, this is a complex one, the Poisson form vanishes on C. So that's not. No, I don't. Yeah, I'm not quite sure. I mean, obviously, every generalized complex manifold has this, of even type, has this canonical section of L dual, which if first Chern class of L is non-zero, must vanish somewhere. So every generalized complex manifold where the generic structure is symplectic has something like this divisor. I guess one could say that.
Do you understand what this section is for an ordinary complex manifold?
For an ordinary complex manifold, it's zero. Because an ordinary complex manifold, the pure spinner is a decomposable one. It has no degree zero component. So it's only the case, you know, if you have a general structure, you know, somewhere, this generic symplectic type structure somewhere, then you'll get this degeneration. I don't have the big picture, really. Okay, well, but maybe there is a. So maybe some of these things could be made a little clearer if I now change tack a little bit. And, you know, here I've been talking about generalized complex manifolds, and I've been giving you some examples. But, you know, nobody's asked me the question, well, this is a generalization of complex structure. Could it be that any sphere is a generalized complex manifold? No. Well, so, you know, what are the topological conditions, necessary topological conditions, which a generalized complex manifold should have? And so that's something which one needs to look at. And in fact, I'll do that now, but there's a reason for doing it, because it'll come back a little bit later when we talk about something called generalized Kähler manifolds. So let's look at then at these. Forget about the integrability question, and let's look at the topological conditions. So we want E, we want a subbundle of T plus T star, which is maximally isotropic, and E intersection E bar is equal to zero. So as I say, this condition says we have a complex structure on T plus T star, and this isotropic condition, well, it was there, if you like, because of the analogy with the Dirac structure, but it gives us something else here. So let's just recall what happens, that T plus T star has the, if you like, structure group O, N, N. So, well, let's call it, so I'm on an even dimensional manifold, this, if you like, is the natural structure group of T plus D star. We have now this and this give us a complex structure on T plus D star, or let's say a complex structure on this bundle. And this isotropic condition, so this implies that J is compatible with the metric. Okay, so isotropy implies that J is compatible with the metric. And what's the good way of saying that? What it means is that it's actually Hermitian. I mean, to say that, if you like, when you're on a Kähler manifold, then when you complexify the metric, then that's of, well, the metric is of type 1-1, it's got no 2-0 component. And so that's equivalent to this isotropy condition. So, I mean, if you spell it out, this isotropy condition says that J is compatible with the metric in the sense that there's a reduction to the structure group U, M, M. So the problem then is to understand what constraints there are in order to have a reduction of the structure group of T plus T star from O to M to M to U, M, comma, M. Now, of course, this U, M, M is homotopy equivalent to the product U, M cross U, M. So topologically, you can reduce the structure to a pair of U, M structures. Now, what does that really mean? It means the following. So there's this picture to have in mind. So here we have these isotropic subspaces, T and T star. And the reduction to UM cross UM is, so this 2M dimensional complex manifold is expressed as a direct sum of two things. So what we have is actually a direct sum decomposition into a subbundle V and its orthogonal complement with regard to the indefinite inner product, where the induced metric on V is positive definite and the induced metric on this is negative definite. Okay? So that's what this reduction means. It means that we have on our manifold inside T plus T star, we have a subbundle V on which the induced metric is positive definite, and it's orthogonal, and the induced metric on its orthogonal complement is negative definite. But also, because of this, because this is isotropic, then the projection onto, the projection onto T is actually an isomorphism, right? Because the kernel, this has a positive definite inner product, so it can't have any isotropic part to it. So what we have actually is a metric on, that gives us a metric on T. Yeah, this is real, right. So that's right. So what we have is a metric on T. In fact, you find that the projections from V perp and V onto T give you the same metric. But what you have is that you have a complex structure on this, let's call that I plus, and another complex structure, I minus, on this one. So this is the picture that you get this way. So as I say, all I'm doing is reinterpreting what it means just to reduce this to the maximal compact subgroup in these terms. So what it says is that you split up T plus T star into a direct sum of two orthogonal subspaces which have, if you like, independent complex structures on. Now, this picture is one which is going to come up in a couple of other situations later on in a more concrete way. See, at the moment all I'm saying is that this is the reduction, there is a topological reduction to this. There are other structures which we'll meet where this comes up very naturally. And so it's like having, so we have a single metric and we have two independent, or apparently independent, complex structures. So, I don't know whether this is the right terminology, you could think of this as a sort of a left-moving unitary structure, and this is a right-moving unitary structure, or something like that. And of course, we have two sets of Chern classes for these. Okay, so the first question is, what are the constraints in order for topologically to have a reduction like this? Well, it's exactly the same then as the constraint to have an almost complex structure. If I give you two different almost complex structures on a manifold, I can reconstruct this picture. So you have to have an almost complex structure on this manifold anyway. So spheres other than maybe the 2-sphere and maybe the 6-sphere, these can't be generalized complex manifolds. So it's not as general as all that, if you like. But of course we have two different sets of Chern classes, and if you work it out, what you find is that twice, so we have this canonical bundle. And I wonder whether I'm going to get the sign right now. I think twice the first Chern class of L is equal to C1 plus C1 minus. Now, is that correct? Or is it L dual? Maybe it's minus. Okay. Sorry about it. Because I got confused with those complex conjugates initially. So we have... So any generalized complex manifold has this line bundle on it, and this is how it relates to these individual Chern classes. Now you may wonder, why can you get a 2 there? Well, remember that the first Chern class modulo 2 is the second Stiefel-Whitney class, so W2 plus W2 is 0, so actually this C1 plus C1 minus does have a can be divided by 2. Well, that's so. All I'm saying here is that here's a way in which we can get the first Chern class of this canonical bundle out of the topological data, which appears in this picture. And if you want to think of what happens in the two situations, so in the case of an ordinary complex manifold, then I plus is equal to I minus, and then the first Chern class of this is either the first Chern class of the manifold, or it's negative. I've got confused here. And in a symplectic case, these two complex structures are the opposite. So this is equal to minus this. And of course, as we know, because it's a symplectic manifold is a generalized Calabi-Yau manifold, the first Chern class of this canonical bundle is equal to zero. Okay, well, all I'm doing here is, if you like, just talking about the topology, but I want you to bear in mind this picture because we'll meet it again. Okay, well, now to finish, I want to talk. I'm okay for until 5:30, is that right? Yeah. I want to talk about generalized complex submanifolds, because here is a situation which where something new comes out of the introduction of the B field, and it's something which makes contact with some work of Anton and Orlov. So how do you define submanifolds in this theory? So now this is really a lousy name, I have to say it, but because everything is generalized, this is the only thing I could think of. But the fact is that a generalized complex submanifold of a generalized complex manifold is not a generalized complex manifold. But that's so if somebody can suggest a better word, then please go ahead. See, the problem is this, that suppose we have a submanifold of M, then of course we have the tangent bundle of Y sitting inside the tangent bundle of M, restricted to Y. But what we're interested in is really T plus T star. And this is this bundle which has a complex structure. And it's pointless asking for the tangent bundle of Y itself to be preserved by the complex structure of T plus T star. You might think that's the obvious thing to do, but it just doesn't make sense, because in general this complex structure is going to mix up T plus T star, and we'll just move T out of T itself. So the thing you have to do is to think of something to compensate for that in T star. So if you look at the annihilator of the tangent bundle of Y sitting inside the cotangent bundle of M. So this is, if you like, this is the conormal bundle of Y. Then that sits inside here. So what we do is so you consider the tangent bundle of Y plus the conormal bundle of Y sitting inside T plus T star. And this in fact is a maximal isotropic subbundle. So you make the definition is that the definition is that a generalized complex submanifold is a submanifold such that ty plus n star y is preserved by J. So then you ask yourself, what are generalized complex submanifolds in the particular cases? So the first example is if we start with an ordinary complex manifold, so if M is complex, then this J, so now I'm going to think of, not in terms of pure spinners, but to go back to J. So J, thought of as a map from T plus T star to T plus T star, has this block diagonal expression, I0 minus I. So this is, okay, this is acting on X psi. Right? So clearly if... when I say I, I'm thinking of the natural I on the T star. You know, given an I on T, it induces an I on T star. So if x is in the tangent bundle of y, this preserves this decomposition. So clearly that implies that y is complex. So for a complex manifold, a generalized complex submanifold is just a complex manifold. So that's at least justification of the name. But now suppose you transform this by a B field. Suppose you take the B field transform. Then what you have to do is you have to conjugate this by 1, 0, minus B, 1. I 0 0 minus I 1 0 1 B. So that comes down to something like this, minus B I plus I B minus I. So what's the difference? Well, still this takes TY to TY, so we still have Y is still complex. But we have this term here. So what that's got to do is to map the tangent bundle of y into its annihilator. So what we have is what that implies is that b of ix1 x2 plus b of x1 ix2 is equal to 0. In other words, that implies that b restricted to y is of type 1, 1. So when you have a B field, then there's a slight change in the definition of a complex submanifold. That this generalized complex submanifold changes. The B field imposes a further constraint on it, in general. That is that its restriction, so it's a closed form, its restriction to this complex submanifold should be of type 1, 1. So that's mildly interesting. It means that in certain cases, maybe on tori, something like that, then you might get B fields which restrict the number of complex submanifolds. But the symplectic situation is more interesting. Now, I don't have time to give you all the details, but suppose now that M is symplectic, then in this case, J has completely the opposite description. So now it looks like this, completely non-diagonal, and so. Now, in this case, so suppose that x is in the tangent bundle, is a tangent vector to y, then if omega inverse xi is in the tangent bundle of y, where xi is in the annihilator, that is essentially saying that omega inverse, or on the normal bundle, is 0. That implies that the thing is co-isotropic. So that's the first condition, and then the second condition is that omega x is in the annihilator of y, and that rather more obviously says that it's isotropic. So co-isotropic and isotropic, that implies that y is Lagrangian. So Lagrangian submanifolds of symplectic manifolds are generalized complex submanifolds when we use this definition. But now when you turn on the B field, you get something in general far more complicated. So let me just tell you what J is. So with a B field, then J looks like this, or J of x psi is equal to this expression, minus omega inverse psi plus bx omega plus b omega inverse b x plus b omega inverse psi. And now you have to work out what this condition means to say that if x is in the tangent bundle, then and psi is in the annihilator, then this is in the tangent bundle. Right? So let me tell you what this implies. It implies that, first of all, that y is co-isotropic, again. So what does a co-isotropic submanifold look like? Well, it might be Lagrangian, but it's in general, it could be bigger than half-dimensional. And when you restrict the symplectic form to it, you get a degeneracy distribution. You get a foliation, foliation defined by Ix omega restricted to y is equal to zero. Now, the conditions are the following, that B, so omega is what's called, it's called a basic form in the language of foliation theory. We have this property, and because it's closed, we also have that the lead derivative of omega restricted to y is equal to zero for any vector field going down this this distribution. So that's just from the formula for the lead derivative. So what that means is that a foliation locally determines your a quotient, and that the symplectic form lives on the quotient. So the symplectic form restricted to here is actually the pullback of a two-form on the quotient. Of course, globally, this is a foliated manifold. It doesn't necessarily have a global quotient. And when you look at the properties of this, what you find is that the B field also has to have this same form, that the B field is also basic. But not only that, but that, if you like, that B plus I omega on the quotient, if you like, this is a 2-0 form for a complex structure. Or let's just say an almost complex structure. So that really comes from this condition here. I mean, this is like saying, basically it's like saying omega inverse b squared is equal to minus 1 on this quotient. But it's also closed, so b is closed and omega is closed, so that implies that actually it's a complex structure on the quotient. So there's a name that you could give to this. What you get is a what's called a transverse Calabi-Yau structure. You have a foliation. And basically, you have the structure, well, it's a transverse holomorphic symplectic structure, actually. Basically, this locally defined quotient is a complex symplectic manifold. Well, this is something that Gualtieri, my student, noticed a year ago. And what it means is that, in principle, there are, on a symplectic manifold with a B field, there are generalized complex submanifolds which are bigger than half-dimensional. It could be Lagrangian, it could be bigger, it could be co-isotropic. The curious thing is that, in fact, these are almost the same type of object that Anton and Olof described in one of their papers in the language of non-Lagrangian A-brains. So this, they argue, as maybe he'll argue himself later on, that there should be more objects in the Foucaille category than just Lagrangian submanifolds, and that something like this is the type of object which appears. The only difference is that in his case, the B field restricted to Y is actually something which is independent. It's really F is the curvature of a connection on the submanifold. So you could say that if the B field restricted to Y is a two-form with integral periods, then it becomes the picture that Kapustin and Olof talked about.
Yeah. So in the symplectic case, if the dimension is 2 mod 4, there are no Lagrangians, which are
because we can never have a complex structure.
Where are we? 2 mod 4? So in 6 dimensions, it's conceivable that you could have 5 dimensional manifolds of this type. Well, an ordinary Lagrangian submanifold is also of this type. It's just that there's, you know, everything that is, you know, the symplectic form is completely zero. So, I mean, you know, Lagrangian is coisotropic. It's just that the quotient is a, you know, is a point. So these submanifolds are always greater or equal to the middle dimension. And of course, the dimension of this quotient is a multiple of 4. So that's on a, for example, on a 4-dimensional generalized complex manifold, you couldn't get this type of thing. We can only get Lagrangian ones. But, that's right. On 4 real dimensional, then. Okay, sorry, the whole manifold. That's right. So this is another issue. I mean, you can discuss when points are complex manifolds and when the whole manifold is a generalized complex manifold. So in fact, okay, I should finish now, but the example that I had of a defined by an anticanonical divisor in a complex surface, then what you find is that the generalized complex submanifolds are any holomorphic curve in here plus the individual points which lie on C. So a point which lies outside here is not a complex submanifold, but a point which lies on this divisor is. So points themselves are not necessarily generalized complex submanifolds. Well, I mean, this is a very intriguing observation. I don't know quite how the language of generalized complex structures applied to symplectic geometry really helps in the derived category point of view, but at least it points out a link between these ideas and the sort of things that Anton is talking about. Okay, so tomorrow I want to tell you how I, if you like, found this type of structure, because it's a very natural approach which leads off in other directions, in the direction of G2 as well. And so I want to show you that it's not, you know, these structures on T plus T star, we don't necessarily have to think of complex ones, even though there's a lot of interest there, but there are other such structures which are worth investigating. Okay, well, I'll finish there today.
She wanted me to remind her that she'll be in her office between 2 and 4. If you need reimbursement forms, if you're not a U.S. citizen, just make something like
and receipts from the hotel. Let's thank Michael.